kind of eat that sticks to your soul. You know who you are and where you're from.
This is Shelley Tomlinson, Belle of All Things Southern, and you're listening to the All Things Southern podcast, brought to you by Jim Taylor Chevrolet in Rayville, Louisiana.
Mama fills up our plates, Papa's saying grace, Louisiana living sweet as sugar on.
Hello, friends. Welcome to another episode of All Things Southern. This is Shelley, and I'll be chatting with Rachel Marie Martin in just a bit about her new release, The Brave Art of Motherhood. But wait, don't get ready to tune us out. Rachel's story holds incredible takeaways for all of us, regardless of our gender or the season of our lives. We'll pop into the kitchen to stir up something good for our bellies, and I'll have some devotional thoughts before we're done. Right now, let's chat. I am fresh off a road trip to South Georgia by way of Tallahassee, Florida, where I was blessed to serve up God's Word and more than a few stories to a group of women at Climax Baptist Church. It was a fun, faith-filled weekend, y'all. It was also eye-opening, at least for yours truly. Apparently, y'all, I'm having trouble with the basics of clothing these days, footwear in particular. Remember when I told y'all about having my shoes on the wrong feet when I came out on the stage in Commerce, Texas? Yes, we all agreed I should have noticed something sooner, but stay with me. Friday night after I spoke, the women of South Georgia gave me a sweet heads up on my latest folly. They were gracious about it, but you can only do so much with some people. And by that, I mean speaker-type folks who talk while wearing two different shoes. Booties, at that. One dear woman told me she was convinced it was part of my message and she had waited all night for the special point. The special point seems clear enough to me, but allow me to spell it out. I ain't right.
Swingin'. Yeah, just a swing.
You're listening to Shelley on All Things Southern.
Welcome back, folks. I am visiting with Rachel Marie Martin. She's the creator of FindingJoy.net, and she has written a fantastic book called The Brave Art of Motherhood. Fight fear, gain confidence, and find yourself again. Rachel Marie Martin, thank you for being by.
I am so glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, I tell you what, with seven children, I think you are the perfect person to write about the brave art of motherhood. I enjoyed your transparency as you told your story. It's a hard one. You talk openly about bankruptcy and divorce and all the hard places. Why did you do that? Why did you let us in?
Do you know, I feel like there's so many of us need somebody to come in and tell them, you know, you're not alone, because we go through this life, at least I did in my own journey, feeling so alone and wondering, is it just me? Is this only my story? Almost like I was watching everybody else live. Mm-hmm. And I decided, and I really felt pressed on my heart, that the way to bring healing isn't by keeping up masks and facades. It's really to kind of let down the guard and to say, here I am. This is what I can give to you all. And we're not alone, but we're stronger when we can talk about the places where we struggle and then help each other up.
Well, you have done exactly that. Your book is full of story, which is my favorite way to relate. It's because Jesus communicated in story and taught that way. And I love story. And you are open about all of your stories. Some of them are, well, all of them are wise, but some of them are just downright funny. Now, I have just got to give you an opportunity to explain resting in the MRI. That just cracked me up. Anyone that has raised children is going to be able to identify with resting in the MRI.
Well, thank you. That is one of my favorite stories. Not maybe in the moment, but it was pretty funny as I laid there. What happened was, is last fall, I broke my ankle unexpectedly. And I laugh even by saying unexpectedly, because whoever plans on breaking their ankle, but I really didn't plan on it. And in the beginning, I kept dismissing it like, it's not really that bad. And I would be on my floor in a lot of pain, and then it would kind of go away. And I just kept dismissing it until one point I knew there was something seriously wrong. So fast forward, I finally get to see a surgeon, and he says, well, you need to have an MRI. And I said, okay. So I knew something was wrong. I needed it diagnosed. And I trekked down to some place in downtown Nashville to get an MRI. And as I'm prepping and not really that nervous, and I get in the machine and they strap my ankle in all tight, and the tech looks at me and he said, now, I need you to hold perfectly still for 20 minutes. You think you can do that? And I looked at him and I said, sir, absolutely. This is going to be awesome. No one's going to bother me for 20 minutes. I'm totally in. And he looked and he said, you would not believe how many moms tell me that this is the best rest they've had in years. So
I love that. I just feel like that anyone can identify with that. You know, I am out of that stage now. I raised two beautiful humans that have given me five wonderful grandchildren. But when I have my grands, or I'm keeping them, or I'm visiting them, you know, it just all floods back. You know, you go to the restroom and then the little fingers are up underneath the door.
Yes.
You know, and you're looking at their little adorable grandchildren fingers going, I will be out in a moment.
Right.
I get that. You need some rest sometimes, and an MRI may not be the likeliest of places, but we'll take it where we can get it. Rachel, I have stickies all in this book. I'm just going to like give you some topics to just speak to, because The Brave Art of Motherhood is all about getting unstuck, right? And finding that courage to dream again and to live again and to pursue this life, this wonderful life Christ has given us. So I'm just going to, and you do it with story again. So I'm just going to give you a couple and let you speak to them. The first right. one that I have stickied is about Elijah learning to jump into the pool. And he says something in here about his mind keeping him from jumping. Talk to us about that.
Well, Elijah, and I don't know if you've known this with your own children or grandchildren, but the names that we give our kids have lots of power. And so anytime I look at Elijah and I think, wow, you are such a spitfire, I just have that little voice in my head that thinks, oh, yes, this is the man in the Bible who prayed down fire and all of this. So I just really know that this is him. He is full of energy. And even on my phone, where he calls me, it says American Ninja Eli because he loves the show. So we moved to Nashville. I moved here about a year and a half ago, and there's a pool. And my kids, having grown up in Minnesota, they do not get as much swimming opportunity times as they do sledding times that when we lived there. So the pool was this great new thing where you really, if you live in the South in the summer, you have to swim or cool down. And so we started going to the pool all the time when we first moved here. But Eli, he didn't know how to swim. So for a long time, they had to learn just how to swim. And then he's this fearless kid, and he kept seeing all these kids jumping. Well, he wanted to jump, but no matter how much we all tried to encourage him to jump, he just couldn't do it. And like, if you've seen kids who've trying to learn to jump, they kind of 1, 2, 3, and then they stay stuck, and 1, 2, 3, and they stay stuck. They can't get their legs. So Eli's like, I just want to jump. Like, he knew it, but his mind and his legs kept stopping him from jumping because he was so afraid. And he knew it was just, if he could just let go of that little bit of fear, because that's what it was, he could finally jump. And once he did, once he got over it, it was like, next thing I look and he's doing cannonballs into the pool. But it was that moment where I knew I couldn't push him in. I couldn't do anything else. It was him having to discover that bravery on his own.
And you had to come to that place. You know, earlier, we kind of glossed over all the very hard things, but I'm feeling like we need to kind of back up just a minute and invite the listeners in to that place in your life where it was hard and it looked like this is what it was going to be and was never what you dreamed of. And you had to let go. You had to jump. So maybe you could talk about that just a minute.
Sure, sure. No, I really did have to jump. I didn't realize it at the moment that I was going through the same thing. And I don't think that we sometimes see our own bravery until we step back and can look at what we've done. Mm-hmm. But I lived for many, many years with deep, deep, painful financial issues where I didn't even understand that it wasn't normal. Because sometimes when you start getting into a cycle or into a place where things aren't normal, your brain is a really powerful way of rationalizing it as being okay. And it took other people saying, you know, this isn't okay. It's not normal to have this happen. And I went through years of having vehicles taken and repossessed from my driveway and the gas utility men coming to turn power off. You know, I've got babies on my hip and counting. There's a story, a time in my life where I remember just feeling at one of the lowest places of being in my car, scrounging around the bottom for change to buy frozen corn for dinner. And it was so humbling to not be able to come up with like 68 cents. I think I was 5 cents short.
Wow.
And it was just this place of where, but I lived in illusion, which is why I talk so much about it. From the outside, nobody would have known that I was in that place of scrounging for the change and the money to buy the corn for my family. But where I had to jump, where I really felt where I was called was, there's a verse in Matthew about being responsible for your family. And if you're not, you might as well tie a rope around your neck or something and drown in the depths of the sea. It was something about taking care of your family. And I had a friend that said to me that this applies to you, Rachel.
Wow.
And I kind of had always looked the other way and thought, no, this isn't my role. This is not my responsibility right now. But at a certain point, they were very straightforward, a straight shooter friend, and said that you need to take care of this. This is not normal. And you are teaching your children this next cycle. Mm-hmm. So I had to basically, throughout the process, I just started taking back and reclaiming the spaces of darkness that had happened in our lives and in the lives of my kids, and started, instead of being a victim to the gas man coming to the door, started actually making a stance and taking responsibility for those places. And that decision is really a place of jumping, because it was fearful. Because prior to that, for most of my adult mothering life, I had been a homemaker and was homeschooling and raising my kids. And it was really this faith that where I've been called and gifted could grow and explode and provide for the family.
Mm. And you, that growth and that explosion, you know, it was tied into the call that you felt to write and to learn about the world of blogging and to put yourself out there. And those calls that you felt that you answered in during that scary time, they required you to maybe not be there with your children, say, you know, when you had to leave and go to another conference or whatever. And I'm struck by the fact that you can be with your children 24/7 and not give them the gift that you actually gave them when you created some space there to reach for your dreams and to do something differently. Because on the back of your book, it reminds me, on the back of your book, when you talk about how the changes that you made mm-hmm. your children happier than they had ever been. That's fascinating. Can you just address that a little?
Well, there's that truth about my kids knew that things weren't rightly ordered. And I love that idea of rightly ordered, because in the scripture, there's lots of talk about that. And there, it's what how we're to live. And even though I could make the illusion and the mask that things were right or okay, underneath it, they could see that things weren't, that there was people knocking at the door, that I was watching the windows all the time, fearful, because I was really living in fear. But what it required from me for a while, especially in the beginning, when I stepped out in faithfulness to not only reclaim their lives, but reclaim my heart, because I lived numb to the world for a long time, was that there were spaces where going all of the paradigms that I thought I was, being the certain type of mom, I had to kind of let go. And I actually pushed myself to work really, really hard to make changes. And that meant that I traveled and spoke for a while. And I struggled with it until I had this remembrance and realization about, and I talk about it, this idea of the harvest time, mm-hmm. of motherhood. And I thought back to my grandfather, who was a farmer in southern Minnesota. And when I was a little girl, we would go down to his farm during the harvest. And my grandpa, during harvest time, he wasn't in the house on the floor playing dominoes with me. My grandpa was in the field. But I never, never questioned if my grandpa loved me. I knew it. I knew when he would come in. I mean, it makes me teary thinking about it. When he would come in and get the food and be replenished and then go right back out, he was doing it out of love for his family.
Right.
And we all have seasons. And I've talked with so many moms that feel guilt, like, I'm not home right now. I have to work and I have to do this at this point. And I just gently want to remind them and remind anybody that's listening that if you're in a harvest place of life or in motherhood, when your giving is providing and changing their lives and doing all of that, then that is rightly ordered. That is a very beautiful thing that we are doing for them.
That is wise, and that is gentle. You do communicate gently, and I appreciate that. But it's from such a place of authenticity. And I know that that's why I responded to your work the way I did, because I appreciate that transparency. It may be a buzzword right now in our culture, but it really does mark you. You are even honest enough to admit that sometimes you were stuck in your gratitude and using your gratitude as an excuse not to go forward. I think our listeners are going to need us to explain that.
Well, that is the part that, as you know, as a writer, sometimes you get that little pulse in your heart right before you hit publish. And I think that's the fear saying, maybe you shouldn't put that out there. But if you look at it closely, it's something that needs to be stated. Mm-hmm. And in my own life, I started to identify the excuses that kept me from taking action. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I had this realization that one of the excuses I used was gratitude. And now that seems so strange, because just like authenticity and vulnerability and transparency is a buzz kind of phrase, gratitude is the same. You can read book after book that says, you know, always go back to gratitude. And it's spoken about in the scriptures. Mm-hmm. But I also realized that in my own life, I had somehow distorted gratitude and used it as an excuse to stop me from making changes. And the example I gave was of, there was a time when our truck was repossessed, and I go through the story, and it was very traumatic, and I felt like very much like, why God, why is this happening to me? But after it happened, instead of changing it, this is how I use gratitude. I said, I'm so thankful we can go get our stuff from the truck. I'm so thankful. I started thinking of all these things with this event that I was thankful about. But in that moment, I didn't need to be grateful for it. I needed to actually drive a stake in the ground and take responsibility for something that should never have happened in the first place.
That's good to say, this is not right. This is not a good thing. This is not how I should be living my life and teaching my children. And you have broken so many patterns, Rachel, in your children's life by taking those jumps and by, you know, facing those excuses that you face all through the book and you talk about so eloquently. I'm going to look at one of my other stickies here. I like this.
You and I like the stickies, so that's good.
Yeah, we're sticky people. I had talk to you a little bit about my sticky obsession, and we didn't get into it. But talk about breaking the cycle. This is a really good, I'm going to read to you a little bit of it and get you started here. You talk about hating the sound of knocking at the door because of what it used to mean. And then you get into how you broke life cycles and how you encourage others to break life cycles. It's kind of a balance between the brain and the heart. Can you talk to us about that?
It is. So in life, there's two ways that time and life moves. One is that linear timeline that we all know. We're all kind of knowing that the kids grow up and we move forward. But if you step back and look at your timeline of life, there can be events that seem to be recurring where we're kind of like, why are we stuck? Why doesn't things ever change? And when you look at them, the chances are that you're stuck in some type of cycle. I've discovered is exponentially high. And this is what I mean by like a cycle is we make an agreement with ourselves. And it could be like, you know, I'm not a good mom because of whatever. Or in my own world, I had an agreement that a good Christian mom doesn't get divorced. And it was a very, very difficult agreement because it was something I grew up believing, but I never wanted to actually look at what I was agreeing to. Right. Or, and it could be whatever. And then we make excuses. Like for me, with our agreements, we can make excuses if it's about whatever. I can't change things right now because the kids are young. If this changes, then I can change it. So whatever the excuse is, you can be busy. And then we perpetuate the cycle by that becomes the reality. Well, if we're waiting till the kids to grow, then we can't change it. And then the reality just furthers, kind of like cements in whatever agreement we've made. And then we are stuck in the agreement, and then the excuses come up again while we can't change it. And it takes actually looking at whatever the agreement is, the agreement that, you know, even good moms stay home, right? And it's just an agreement that somehow we came up with it. But if we can look at it and go, how did that happen? And is that true? And then we can change whatever cycle we're stuck in. It doesn't necessarily even need to be. It could be something as simple as we've always tried to save up to buy a house and we keep getting in this cycle where it doesn't happen. Well, what's leading up to it? So I really want us to look at the idea of where are the places that we're stuck or we think that we can't grow? And what are we telling ourselves? Because, you know, we're taught to renew our minds all the time. And where are we not going in there and balancing what we're telling ourselves with actual truth?
Mm-hmm. That is so good. That is really, really good. I'm listening to you and everything you say kind of reminds me of something else that you said in the book. And I'm thinking again that I need 2 hours to interview you. But you were talking just then about the mind and, you know, how we make these agreements with ourselves. And it reminded me of another one of my stickies. And I have turned over here to your chapter on choosing the right mental targets and how to anchor your mindset in the right thing.
Oh, well, so I love Target, which is the first part of that book, is I love this idea of targets, but I want us to think of target like a bullseye, that type of target. And wow. I learned this one time with the target and the example I give in the book of what how to realize what our mental targets are is if you've ever said, hurry up, we're going to be late to our kids or to yourself or to anybody. And what the reality is our minds don't, because we're saying that because we don't want to be late, correct? I mean, I think we all don't, no one likes to be late. So we say, hurry up, we're going to be late. But what we're really saying is our brains hear, we're going to be late. That is what our brains hear. Like we're aiming actually for the word late. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we step back and think, oh, we're just basically telling everybody, let's just be late, guys. So a simple shift is, let's get going so we're early. And the idea then is everybody in my house or everybody in your house is hearing, we're going to be early. So we're all aiming to be early versus aiming to be late. No one intentionally aims to be late unless it's you're like me and it's the dentist or something. But it's that really simple shift of what are we saying and can we switch it in a way that moves us in a positive direction forward where we're not actually putting our foot on the brake of moving forward without even realizing it.
Oh, that is so good. That mental shift is so incredibly important. It's instead of aiming for that negative, if you aim for the negative, you're going to hit the negative, whether or not you intend to. You're talking to an ex-basketball coach, and my husband's an ex-basketball coach. And I'm thinking as I was reading that chapter and as I'm listening to you right now, my husband used to talk to our kids. They were both fantastic athletes, and that's not bragging. They just were. As little kids, he taught them, we used to use this analogy, the little man in your head. I remember when my son was pitching as a young child, and Phil taught him, his name is Philip, my husband is Phil, my son is Philip. And Phil taught Philip that there was a little man in his head, and that he had to be a friend, and not a foe, and how to not let that little man say, don't throw the ball wide on a pitch. Instead, the little man says, throw the ball at the target. And, you know, and you don't accentuate that negative. And then later, I remember as I was coaching basketball that I always felt sorry for kids when I would hear people from the stands telling them, don't do this, don't do that, right, instead of do this one thing, because that last image, that last word that you have, you know, if your mom is saying you're going on the court and they're like, don't foul out. Well, that child's taking the court going, don't foul out, right, don't foul out. And then they right, whack someone in the head because, you know, don't foul out. Instead of saying, you know, be composed, you know, be aggressive on defense,
right,
in those type of things. And so that shift is so very important. I really like that chapter. I want them to read that chapter. I want them to read the whole entire book. And then I want them to go to findingjoy.net and follow you on all of your social media and get to know you, because I think there's a lot more wisdom where this book comes from. So tell me about your heroes in the writing world, or the people that you speak to and are listened to. Who inspires you?
Well, there's a book that I love that's several, it's probably 20 years old now, and it's called One Year Off. And I believe it's by David Cohen. All of a sudden, I can't remember, but what I loved about it, and it's a story about a family that sold everything or put it into storage and traveled the world. And I remember reading it in a place in a time when I didn't know if things could ever change. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, wow, to have that type of freedom where he could just decide we're going to do this. And it was inspiring to me in a way, because it wasn't preachy and it wasn't like, you can do this, it's so easy. It was just narrating. It was just the story of somebody's life. And anybody that writes that has that or speaks that has that ability to say, because sometimes I think when people tell you it's easy, you're like, well, that's because you're on the outside right now.
Thank you.
Right. So I love this. Right. Like, it seems easy at that point. But I love this kind of grit and tenacity about actually saying, you know what, when you're in that spot, I know it feels overwhelming, but it's really about recognizing that emotion and then coming alongside somebody and saying, we can do this, you can do this, you have these tools. And that's what I really loved about that book.
Okay, I'm going to have to get that book. And then I'm going to make a recommendation for you before we wrap up here. I think everyone in the world has already read Love Does by Bob Goff. I had not until just, I think, this past week, just a couple of days ago, actually. I was on a plane and downloaded it. I'm thinking maybe now I can read this book. And now I know why the whole world responded to Love Does.
That is so cool.
Have you read it?
You know what? I haven't, but here's a really cool coincidence. My oldest daughter, who starts off the book, graduated from Seattle Pacific University this year, and he was the commencement speaker. Oh, so
cool. Well, yes. Got to get it and read it. I tell you what, I laughed so much on the plane that I know my seatmate thought, what are you doing? You know, and generally I talk to anyone and everyone, but this guy was in his little bubble and you could tell he didn't want to talk, you know, but he was probably wondering what I was laughing at, because I mean, it's very, very good and very, very wise and very humorous. So there's a recommendation from me and from Rachel. Now, what was the name of yours again, Rachel?
One Year Off.
One Year Off. So y'all Google that. I'll put it in the show notes. Yep. I'll find it and put a link in the show notes for you. Rachel Marie Martin, you are just a joy. Thanks for being by All Things Southern.
Thank you so much. I had the best time chatting with you. I like you and I joke about we could chat for a long time. So let's get our sweet tea.
Okay, we'll do it again. Take care and God bless.
Thank you.
I remember singing with Roy Rogers at the movies when the West was really wild. 'Cause I was country when country wasn't cool. Yeah, I was country when country wasn't cool.
You're listening to All Things Southern. Now here's your host, the author of Suck Your Stomach In and Put Some Color On, Shelley Tomlinson.
It's All Things Southern Kitchen Time. The men around here are almost through harvesting. Hallelujah. Give us a week and it will all be in the bins. And what isn't in the bins will have been shipped out to the grain elevators. Will they slow down? You're kidding, right? they're going to switch gears and try to get the land ready and laid by. That's a farming term. It means before the winter rain set in. The goal is to have it as ready as possible for planting come spring. All that to say, I'm stirring up another hearty meal for my hard-working and beloved farmer. It's my cornbread meat pie, and it's going to keep him going. I'll show you the steps so you can bless your bunch. Remember, you can get this recipe at allthingssouthern.com along with a picture of a half-eaten cornbread meat pie. Yeah, I forgot to snap that for y'all. But back to the recipe. Let's do it. We'll begin by browning a pound of ground beef with a large chopped onion. We're going to drain the grease and then we'll return it to a heavy cast iron skillet along with a half a cup of chopped bell pepper, a can of tomato sauce, and a can of whole kernel corn. Of course, I hesitate to tell you this, but I've got freshly frozen corn from the farm in the freezer, and that's what I'll be using. Don't hate. We'll also add a cup and 3/4 of water, a tablespoon of chili powder, and then we'll salt and pepper it to taste. Just let this cook on low while we make the cornbread topping. Special note, if you don't have a large enough skillet, bless your heart, and I do mean that sincerely, you can turn this out into a greased casserole dish before topping it with your cornbread mixture. Now, about that cornbread. We'll stir together 3/4 cup of cornmeal with a tablespoon each of all-purpose flour and sugar and a tablespoon and a half of baking powder. We'll stir in a well-beaten egg, a tablespoon of melted butter, real butter please, and a half a cup of milk. This is what we're going to pour over our meat mixture. Now, if you need to take another shortcut, use a little box of Martha White cornbread mix. It's all good. Now, when you pour your cornbread mixture over the top, it's going to sink below the surface just a bit, but that's okay. It'll rise while it bakes and come out all brown and crispy. That's my cornbread meat pie, and it's mighty good eating from the Bell's Kitchen to yours. I fell down an interesting rabbit hole a few days ago. When corresponding with readers, I often type the words, "Let's worship together forever." It really just kind of spills out of my heart onto the page these days. Only that morning, as I was typing it out, spell check, or Holy Spirit, you decide, put spaces in between the word together, because apparently I didn't type it fast enough, so that it came out to get hurt. Stay with me here. Our initial response to offense or pain, real or perceived, is to withdraw into a cave of our own design where we can nurture ourselves. Only what we do is nurture the pain and protect our wounds. Am I right? So I'm weird, I give you that, but I can't shake the significance here. Our enemy wins when he convinces us to retreat from the people who love us and want to help us. Get it? He is out to get her, if he can get that one separated. Don't let him. If this is for you, come back. Engage with the body of Christ. We're here and you're loved. Matthew 18:20 reads, "For where two or three have gathered together in my name, I am there in their midst." That's it for this week, y'all. Now, I'm supposed to remind y'all to subscribe to the podcast, review it, share it. You know the routine. Do it if you have a chance. I hope to see you next time right here on All Things Southern. This is Shelley with Hugs for All.